Good afternoon, everybody. I hope you're enjoying your lunch. My name is Joe Rose, and I'm the president of the San Francisco Lawyers Chapter, a stalwart outpost in the city of San Francisco of the Federalist Society. It's my pleasure to introduce the moderator of our luncheon panel, the Honorable Carlos Bea. Judge Bea has been on the Ninth Circuit since 2003, to which he was unanimously confirmed after being nominated by President George W. Bush. Prior to that, he was, for about 13 years, a judge in the Superior Court. And over the years has a significant commitment to teaching, mentorship, and he's also a very long-term active member of the Lawyers Chapter. He and Mrs. Bea come to many events and are much appreciated participants in those. So we really appreciate having him around the Lawyers Chapter. I should also say that Judge Bea is the only member of the San Francisco Lawyers Chapter who is also an Olympian, having played for the Cuban Olympic basketball team. And so in every respect, I can say that Judge Bea is a pillar of the Federalist Society in San Francisco. So it's my honor to introduce him and our panel this afternoon. Thank you.
Thank you, Joe. When I hear that mention is made of my playing on the Cuban Olympic basketball team, I always like to add a footnote in the form of a disclaimer. I played for the Cuba BC, before Castro, but. Secondly, I see myself more as an Olympic tourist than an Olympic player, because our team actually went 2-5. However, we do in the family have an Olympic athlete, our son Sebastian, who rode for a state institution located in the East Bay. I went to Stanford. Actually did win a silver medal at the Sydney Olympics in 2000 in the men's pair. So he's the athlete, I'm the tourist. Today we're going to discuss donor privacy and campaign related speech. The issue has been made come front and center because state legislators have proposed new state laws against dark money and advocated new disclosure regimes, as well as increased restrictions on speech and political engagement by key public officials who coordinate on a national level. And they impose heightened donor disclosure regulations, as well as requiring more detailed financial disclosures. To discuss this very important subject, we have a couple of really distinguished and knowledgeable persons. I can't think of people who know more about this area than the two we have with us on my left, and that is not a political comment. is Professor Rick Hazen, who's a Chancellor Professor of Law and Political Science at University of California, Irvine. Hazen is a nationally recognized expert in election law and campaign finance regulation and a co-author of the leading casebook on election law. He's also the founding co-editor of the quarterly peer-reviewed publication Election Law Journal. He's the author of over 100 articles on election law issues published in numerous journals, including the Harvard Law Review, the Stanford Law Review, and Supreme Court Law Review. He was recently elected, in 2009, to the American Law Institute and served as an advisor on ALI's law reform project, The Principles of Election Law and Resolution of Election Disputes. He's been named one of the 100 most influential lawyers by the National Law Journal, and his op-eds and commentaries have appeared in many publications, including the New York Times, Washington Post, Politico, and Slate. He's often quoted in an election law blog, and his newest book, The Justice of Contradictions, Antonin Scalia and the Politics of Disruption, will be published in 2018 by Yale University. He holds a BA degree with highest honors from UC Berkeley, a JD, MA, and PhD in political science from UCLA. After law school, Hazen clerked for the Honorable David R. Thompson, of late and happy memory, a judge on the Ninth and Circuit Court of Appeal. Mr. Hazen has taught at Chicago Kent Law School and also at Loyola Law School. He joined the UC Irvine faculty in 2011. He's a faculty member of the UC Irvine Jack Peltison Center for the Study of Democracy. On my right is Brad Smith. Brad Smith is the Blackmore and Nault Professor of Law at Capital University Law School in Columbus, Ohio, and the founder and chairman of the Institute for Free Speech, formerly the Center for Competitive Politics in Alexandria, Virginia. The Institute for Free Speech is the nation's largest public litigation firm and think tank devoted exclusively to defending and promoting freedom of speech. From 2000 to 2005, Professor Smith served on the Federal Election Commission, including vice chairman 2003 and chairman in 2004. During his tenure, the Wall Street Journal dubbed Smith as the only honest man in this bordello. Professor Smith's writings have appeared in the Yale Law Journal and the Pennsylvania Law Review. His 2001 book, Unfree Speech, The Folly of Campaign Finance Reform, you can get an idea of where he comes from, was praised by George Will as the year's most important book of governance. His writings were cited in the majority opinion in Citizens United versus FEC, and he was co-counsel in SpeechNow.org, the case that gave constitutional protection to super PACs. In 2010, Professor Smith was awarded the Bradley Prize by the Bradley Foundation. He's the chairman of Ohio's 1851 Center for Constitutional Law and the Buckeye Institute for Public Policy Studies. He is cum laude graduate of both Kalamazoo College and the Harvard Law School and holds an honorary doctorate from Augustana College. So with that, we're going to ask each of the two professors to give a 5 to 7 minute opening, then we're going to open up the background for questioning. The subject of financial disclosures of campaign and charitable donation is, I think, very important in this day and age. We've seen examples of it. If you go back far enough to the 1950s and 60s in NAACP versus Alabama. Alabama sought to shut down the NAACP as a foreign corporation not properly doing business in Alabama because they had enlisted the people who were behind the NAACP, their donor lists and their board of directors and officers. And the Supreme Court affirmed a judgment enjoining the exclusivity of that information in order to prevent violence to the members of the NAACP. Fast forward to recently, we have the situation of Brendan Eck, the CEO of Mozilla, who gave $1,000 to the Prop 8 campaign and was forced out of office as CEO of Mozilla because it was made known that he was a proponent of, against same-sex marriage, as was Prop 8. The third, I think, and more current situation is an interesting case that was decided in the Central District of California by Judge Manny Real, and is presently on appeal to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeal. I won't say too much about it for that reason, but it's the Harris versus Americans for Prosperity, holding that the Attorney General was enjoined against requiring AFP, the charitable corporation, the 501c3, was enjoined against making their Schedule Bs, which are the filings with the Franchise Tax Board 990s, and have all the, or should have, all the names of the persons who've donated more than $5,000 to the charitable organization, including well-known donors such as the Brothers Koch. So that case is now before the Ninth Circuit. So with that background, I'd like to open a dialogue with Professor Hazen.
Thank you. Good afternoon. It's a pleasure to be back here. This is a lovely location. If you don't get blown away outside, it's a really beautiful day. Back in 1976, the Supreme Court, in a case called Buckley versus Valeo, which is famous for a number of decisions related to campaign finance, upheld new federal campaign disclosure laws against First Amendment challenge, pointing to three important government interests. They're government interests that were important then and that are still important today. First is the interest in preventing corruption by being able to examine who's giving large contributions to candidates, to parties, to groups. You can look for people using undue influence. You can look for the potential for bribery to occur. And justices, even Justice Thomas, long ago said that disclosure is a much more, much less of a draconian way of dealing with the problem of corruption than imposing limits on the amounts that people can contribute to campaigns. And so disclosure is a more narrowly tailored way to deal with the corruption problem. The second interest that the court in Buckley recognized was what's come to be known as the information interest. Voters rely on information about campaign donors in order to figure out how they can vote. Voters are busy, they need some cues to help them. So for example, if I told you there was a ballot proposition that was supported by the National Rifle Association and opposed by the Sierra Club, I'm guessing that everyone in this room would know how to vote on that ballot proposition without even knowing what the ballot proposition was about. So we rely on cues. And one good example of this in California is that there was a proposition in 2010, Proposition 16, which would prevent public utilities from competing against private utilities. The Yes campaign spent $43 million. The No campaign spent less than $1 million. The measure went down to defeat. 52 to 48. And we think the reason it was defeated was that every ad that said vote yes on this measure said paid for by funders including Pacific Gas and Electric. And in fact, Pacific Gas and Electric, a private utility that didn't want competition from public utility, gave basically all of the money for this campaign. And so voters used that information and voted it down. The third interest that the court recognized in Buckley to support disclosure is the enforcement interest. By disclosing who donors are, you can figure out if any other campaign finance laws are being broken. So for example, if we had adequate disclosure as to Facebook ads run during the election in 2016, we'd have a sense of whether Russian government agents actually were behind some of these ads. Without effective disclosure, you can't enforce the ban on foreign money in elections. So three weighty interests supporting disclosure. On the other side, the court said, there is no general First Amendment right to anonymity. And the court has said this in the campaign finance context more than once. But there is a right to be free of harassment. And we heard from the judge about the NAACP case. There's another case called Brown versus Socialist Workers Party. In those cases, people faced actual violence. There were people who were assassinated for being part of the NAACP in Florida at the same time as this NAACP case. The Koch brothers today are not facing fears of violence. And so in fact, if you look at most campaign finance measures that people are voting on, nobody is facing any threats of retaliation or violence. And if you take some of the hottest button issues, for example, the question of same-sex marriage, we had in both the Doe versus Reed case and in the Protect Marriage versus Bowen case, two federal district courts do a detailed examination as to whether or not the average donor to these campaigns faced harassment, and the courts found no, they did not. The worst they faced was a little bit of some uncomfortable situations, including being mooned or flipped off. This was the extent of the harassment. And the courts recognized that economic boycotts are not harassment. I'm going to quote from Justice Scalia, who said in the Doe versus Reed case, requiring people to stand up in public for their political acts fosters civic courage, without which democracy is doomed. For my part, I do not look forward to a society which, thanks to the Supreme Court, campaigns anonymously, citing this McIntyre case, which we can talk about, and even exercising the direct democracy of initiative and referendum, hidden from public scrutiny and protected from the accountability of criticism. This does not resemble the home of the brave. And I think Justice Scalia was right here, that people should stand up for their convictions. If you can make a credible threat in the rare instance that you face harassment, you should be able to be exempt from these laws, but otherwise, disclosure serves these important government interests. Now finally, the last point I'll make is, even though I believe that virtually all of the disclosure laws are constitutional, it doesn't mean they are wise. And so some of the thresholds in state laws requiring disclosure of contributions of up to as little as $100, to me, public disclosure makes very little sense in terms of preventing corruption, providing valuable information, or deterring major crimes. I want to know about the big money. I want to know who's giving the $10,000, the $100,000, the $1 million. And so I support raising contribution limits, raising disclosure thresholds for contribution limits and for expenditures dramatically, so that the individual who gives $100 to an unpopular cause is not going to have his or her privacy invaded. I don't think that's constitutionally required, but I think that that would make some sense. So I think we can have a kind of a sensible approach to disclosure that gives the public the valuable information it needs without encroaching on the basic privacy rights of the average individual. Thanks.
Brent? Okay.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to be out here in California. It's a beautiful place. I don't get out here very often, and they usually turn me away at the border as a person of low moral character when I try. And it is a pleasure to see a lot of folks that I don't get to see, and including my former colleague at the FEC, Daryl Wold, I saw out here. I haven't been able to say hi to him yet. And my former chief counsel there, Allison Hayward, and Nathan Lowenstein, who worked for me while he was an intern as a UCLA law student, and some other old friends. I see Manny Klausner right up here in front, and Chuck Bell and others. And one person, this is probably embarrassing a little bit, but I do want to say a little bit, also in the audience is Dan Lowenstein, and it's former professor, now professor emeritus at UCLA Law. And it's worth noting that I think Dan, it's fair to say, has been a mentor to both Rick and I. So we're up here on the other side, and he truly represents, I think, a true scholar who's was interested in promoting simply good other young scholars and took an interest in both of us. He was wrong in one case, obviously, but you know, still shows that. And so I'm very pleased to see him here. And thinking of people I see, John Fund, I saw earlier. John, the journal doesn't say who writes their editorials. John may have been the person who wrote the editorial that Judge Bea quoted at the beginning about the bordello. And when I was serving on the FEC, my wife wouldn't read the papers. I would discourage her from doing so. She'd get really upset when I'd be criticized. This would really bug her and really work on her. And this particular day, I brought this home, and I said, "You got to see the Wall Street Journal today. You know, look at this editorial, Only Honest Man." And she looked at it, and she crossed her arms. She says, "What are you doing in the bordello?" In any case, down to business here. Rick quite correctly describes the interest that the government found, or that the courts found compelling in the Buckley case. But it's worth noting a couple things here. First, while Buckley did uphold general disclosure laws, it did so only after substantially narrowing their scope. The Federal Election Campaign Act amendments of 1974 would have applied those disclosure laws to anybody who was spending $1,000 relative to a candidate or for the purpose of influencing an election. And the court chopped most of that off. It dramatically shrank the size of the disclosure and said the only people who need to disclose all of their donors are essentially candidates, parties, and political committees, that is PACs, that exist specifically for the purpose of electing people to office. And it said when we talk about other groups, including groups that periodically engage in politics, which would include most groups like you think about the Sierra Club or the Rifle Association or NARAL Pro-Choice or Right to Life or anything like that, they just have to disclose their spending. They don't have to disclose who all of their donors are, in part because their donors give money for all kinds of different reasons other than electing candidates. And so to say that Buckley just kind of blankly upheld this is certainly true, but it's not the entire story. Now, the court did cite three reasons for that, and as Rick said, one is bribery, the second is enforcement, and the third is the effort to present info. I want to point out, by the way, before I get into that, there's one thing that we should note. The current debate over disclosure is not about reducing disclosure of candidates and political parties and PACs in reporting who their donors are. To my knowledge, there is no significant effort at the federal level whatsoever that would repeal or narrow the scope of that disclosure. Nor, to my knowledge, is there anything really going on at the states. There may be a handful of states that have slightly upped the disclosure thresholds, which Rick and I agree on. They should be higher. But there's no major effort to roll that back. Rather, what is going on right now is an effort to increase the amount of disclosure substantially by requiring people to disclose who are in exactly the position that Buckley said they don't have to disclose. That is, people who periodically engage in politics, organizations that periodically engage in politics. And the idea is, it's not enough for us to know that the Chamber of Commerce supports this, which might be a pretty good clue to voters. I see voters, you know, what Chamber of Commerce? Who knows what they're about? You know, I think people know when they see the Chamber of Commerce sponsor something going on. The goal is to say, we want to know who gave money to the Chamber of Commerce. And if the people who gave money to the Chamber of Commerce is the, you know, the State Chamber of Commerce, then we want to know who gave money to the State Chamber of Commerce that gave money to the National Chamber of Commerce. And if some local Chamber of Commerce gave money to the State Chamber, then we want to know who gave money to the local Chamber that gave money to the State Chamber that gave money to the National Chamber that spent money relative to a campaign. So this is what we're really talking about, is a substantial expansion of the disclosure laws into the private sector of American life, where people are also not merely talking about candidates, but much of this effort is even going to people who are simply talking about issues to one another and whether or not they should have to do so. Now, if we look at the rationales for this, the first is the bribery rationale. Now, remember, when FACA was passed in the 1970s, you could walk into a congressman's office with a paper bag full of money, talk to him about how vitally important it was that we continue these subsidies for green energy, for this is very important to our company, and then say, well, I'm so glad, Congressman, that you've agreed to support that, and I want to leave you a little campaign contribution here, right? And by the way, I just leave nobody knew about it. And you can walk out, right? That was lawful. Even if you didn't do that, even if you, like most people, were playing perfectly above board, note that at that time, a congressman or senator on their retirement could simply keep all the money in their campaign account. So if you made a large, and there were no limits on what you could contribute to the campaign. So if you made a large contribution to the campaign and then the person decided to retire, it went into their private pension fund, as you might call it, the 401k, so to speak, is what those funds were. I don't know that that bribery rationale makes a lot of sense, particularly with groups that are doing independent expenditures. And that's what we're really talking about in the dark money debate. We're talking about groups that are spending money independently of candidates, because if they give it to the candidates, it still has to be reported. When they spend it independently, we lose that opportunity for quid pro quo bribery type exchange. Moreover, it's now the senators, even if it went into their funds, which it doesn't, senators and congressmen can no longer just pocket those monies when they retire. So I'm not sure that the bribery rationale takes us too far anymore. The second was this enforcement rationale. But again, when you consider that independent expenditures under Citizens United and speechnow.org versus FEC. You think I know the case I was co-counsel on. And I see my co-counsel really did the yeoman's work. Steve Simpson also deserves to be mentioned, and he's here today, I think, on the next panel. In any case, these groups are not giving money to candidates, right? And moreover, they can take unlimited sums, and they can take unlimited sums from corporate entities and union entities and so on. So the idea that we need to have this information disclosed so that we can see if they're getting amounts that are illegal, right, or amounts that are from sources that aren't allowed, is pretty much disappeared. So increasingly then, the pressure falls on a single interest noted in Buckley, and this is this voter information interest. The problem is, this interest can't really hold the pressure it is being asked to bear. There's actually very little evidence that voters care or use this information. Now, Rick cited ads appearing on the face of a ballot initiative, all right? But notice again, that merely required a statement as to an industry paying for it. And this is what goes on the ad. It's not requiring the names of all the funders. But let's go further than that. When we talk about what voters actually do. Voters say they want disclosure, overwhelmingly. If you ask voters, should people have to disclose, they say, yes, people should have to disclose. If you ask voters, should your contributions be disclosed, you actually get a majority say, no, my contribution should not be disclosed, right? If you ask them if their employer should be disclosed, you get a large majority, quite a sizable majority, saying, no, my employer's information should not be disclosed, although pretty much, well, the federal laws and pretty much all state laws require information on the employer and so on to be disclosed. So people aren't quite so pro-disclosure as they first seem. But just as they're not quite as pro-disclosure as they at first seem, they don't use it as much as they say. While they say they use it, experiments, controlled experiments, don't show that they use it. When voters are given different packets of information to make decisions on, right, we find that about 40% of voters don't use the information at all, period. Another 35% make only minimal use of the information. But moreover, the last thing that voters read is the stuff on campaign finance contributions. They read that only after they have read everything else they can possibly read on the subject that they're interested in reading, right? This is boring to them. It doesn't do anything. It erodes our democracy. It erodes our discussion of issues. You know, such and such a campaign raised $1,162,384.72. The opponents raised $972,316.44. You know, they had so much cash on hand, and everybody has fallen asleep, and this is why probably also newspapers are dying, right? Because they run these articles all the time, and people don't find it informative or helpful to them. And this is the other thing we find, is that even the people who use this information, these experiments by David Primo at the University of Rochester, they don't find that it affects their ability, it doesn't improve on the cues from other information they have. In other words, there's enough other information out there, they get the cues. And so we look at something like Proposition 16. Maybe it failed because it's a really bad bill that was being promoted by one company and it didn't take a lot of effort to figure that out and people voted against it. Maybe that's the reason. It's possible that it was just because it was, you know, put on the ads. But I suspect that it was probably viewed as self-serving special interest litigation or legislation that people didn't want to do. So quickly, let me say that I don't think we can handle that. Now, it is worth doing one final thing, which is to get out there a little bit of the sense of this alleged dark money that's out there, undisclosed money. It's about, in candidate races, about 2.7% of amount that was spent in 2016. So it's not a huge amount, and I think we need to ask how far do we want to push to try to squeeze this last money out there if people have reasons for keeping their privacy. Of course people have a right to boycott someone else. We can do that, right? You don't have to go to Chick-fil-A. You can do these things. You can make your decisions. The question is not whether voters have a right to boycott. The question is whether the government should be able to force people to reveal information that they don't want to reveal. I suspect most of you, if you stopped at the local coffee shop on the way here, you know, you didn't ask the person behind the bar, now, are you a Republican or a Democrat? Do you have an opinion on the Federalist Society? And if you did, they would have to tell you, and or would they have to tell you about their other opinions on other issues or whether they were divorced because you said, well, you know, I don't believe in divorce. I'm an old-fashioned person. And, you know, they'd say it's none of your stinking business, right? And that's a fair enough, I think, approach to say. The idea that we should be holding people accountable, which is the phrase that's used, is a fundamentally illiberal idea. How do you hold somebody accountable for non-tortious legal speech? And what they seem to be saying is they're perverting this informational interest. They're no longer saying, I need this to help me judge the truth or falsity of these claims. Rather, they're saying, I know what I think about this speech, and I hate it. And I want to stop those people from speaking because I don't want other people to be influenced by it or buy into it. That's my goal. And so I'm going to hold them accountable. And what does that mean? It means I'm going to boycott them, punish them, try to give them harm outside of simply replying to their speech, create other harms that are unconnected to the speech in which they have engaged. I don't think it's simple enough to say nobody's threatened. First, not all the cases go that way, so you can't just rely on a couple cases. For example, in the case mentioned by Judge Bea, Judge Real found that there were death threats against the Kochs and issued an injunction in AFP. But I also wonder whether that's really the standard that we want. There weren't always death threats against everybody in the old cases where people worked very hard to create the right to anonymity in Thomas v. Collins with union organizers, in Talley versus California with picketers here in the Los Angeles area. Do we really want to say, until somebody's issuing death threats, you're okay? You know, and we have all kinds of situations here in which people can be harmed. They worry about their children being harmed. We don't necessarily need the threats. Plus, people just have other reasons for wanting to be anonymous. So given the tenuous incentive people have to participate in politics, I'm not sure that we want to make it all that much harsher. You know, Justice Scalia talks about civic courage, and all my admiration for Justice Scalia aside, you know, I'm sorry that Hamilton, Madison, and Jay just didn't have much civic courage. They weren't willing to publish the Federalist Societies under their own name. We weren't fighting the revolution then. You know, things were generally peaceful. Folks have other reasons for wanting to do this. And it's, and with all due respect again, because I don't, I mean, I think he's a great man, right, unqualified. But I do think you can lose touch with the common people when you have a lifetime job, so you're not in danger of having your employer boycott it until you leave or he fires you. You're not in danger of having your business affected or your promotional aspects ended. He has lifetime Secret Service protection, so you, don't need
you to haven't worry. You haven't descended on the Ninth Circuit.
So you don't have to worry, in theory, about people dropping dead rabbits in front of your door or scrawling graffiti on your house or car or some of these types of things as well. So in the end, I think that as we think about disclosure, we need to say, you know, is it fundamentally illiberal, this push toward more and more disclosure? I think yes. Is it unconstitutional? I think probably more of it should be. Whether we're going to make an absolute line, I don't know. But I think the courts have drawn far too harsh a line in saying, until you're about to be lynched, at which point it's basically too late anyway, we're going to require disclosure of your personal political beliefs, your associations with other people, and your contributions. Thank you.
I'm going to use my position as the moderator to start the discussion. Professor Haslam, you mentioned that the ALP case does not involve death threats to the Kochs. I'm going to read you just a section of it, and then you can tell me what you think is the basis going to be for disregarding this evidence when it's heard on appeal. The court also heard from Mark Holden, general counsel for Koch Industries, who testified that Charles and David Koch, two of AFP's most high-profile associates, have faced threats, attacks, and harassment, including death threats. Not only have these threats been made to the Koch brothers because of their ties with ALP, but threats have also been made against their families, including their grandchildren. Mr. Pope has faced similar death threats due to his affiliation with AFP and has even encountered boycotts of his nationwide stores, Variety Wholesalers. So would that qualify under NAACP versus Alabama as a basis for bottoming the instruction?
Well, I think it potentially could. First, I point out the case is pending. I don't know how much we should discuss it, but I will say that Judge Rail's opinions have been reversed more than once, and I think that there are questions about whether or not the factual findings he made are going to be supported by substantial evidence, but I don't know that we should discuss that specific. But let's talk about the Koch brothers' network that is their goal for the last election was to raise approximately $600 million from not just themselves personally, but also from their network of donors. They're major players in politics. I'm sure that they get nasty letters, just like I've gotten death threats on left on my answering machine. It hasn't stopped me from speaking out on issues. I wouldn't be surprised if Professor Smith has gotten some very nasty things. Politics is not beanbag, right? It's an old expression. You need to stand up for what you believe in. If there is credible evidence, I'm more worried about the person who gives a small donation and faces threats of violence. So in the Socialist Workers Party case, we had destruction of property, police harassment of a candidate, firing shots into an office. I would say that would rise to the level of harassment. I would need to know more about these specific threats and how credible they were before I could say that. But when someone is a large player in politics, they should stand up for who they are. They shouldn't be able to hide behind a name like American Futures Fund, and people can't have the information that they need. And I strongly disagree with Professor Smith. I'm the one who said it shouldn't be a debate, and now I'm getting the bad tone, so let me calm down. I strongly disagree that things are essentially the same. Here's what's changed. While the law has remained the same on the federal level, the ability to evade it has been greatly raised, thanks to cases like Citizens United and Speech Now. So today, if I want to anonymize my donation, I can simply give it to, I can create an LLC in Delaware, and I can make a contribution. I can even give $130,000 to a porn star to keep that person quiet, and no one would know who I am. The information would not have to be disclosed, because what would be disclosed was that an LLC made an expenditure. And through these 501c4s, I'm not so worried about who's giving to the Chamber of Commerce. I have a pretty good idea about that. But there are plenty of other groups that form 501c4s that used to not engage in so much election-related activity until we had the rise of super PACs and the evasion that started with Karl Rove's Crossroads GPS, the evasion of laws. It's now very easy for individuals and even foreign individuals and governments to funnel money into an LLC that then makes a contribution to a super PAC. You get disclosure, but it's not effective disclosure. That's why in California, they're trying hard to make the disclosure effective. And in the case that Brad mentioned involving the involving Proposition 16, in California, we have to list the top contributors to a ballot measure campaign on the ad itself. So it literally said Pacific Gas and Electric. And so people knew that, and people used that information.
Thank you. Now, Professor Hazen, Brad, talked about the three elements of it that are foundational to the Buckley opinion. To what extent does Citizens United limit Buckley to the first one, which was the prevent corruption or the appearance of corruption?
If I follow the question right, on the disclosure end, you know, Citizens United says essentially that you can no longer, and at least with its stepchild, SpeechNow.org, says you can't limit contributions that are made to organizations that only do independent expenditures, nor can you limit independent expenditures simply because they're made by a corporation or a union. That frees these groups up to do more spending. On the disclosure side, I don't think that it has, this deleterious effect that Rick thinks. It's true that groups give money to, businesses tend to give money to trade associations. Very, very few spend money directly. But most people know what trade associations are about. And you can even take a group like Crossroads, which I loved them when Crossroads came out, because I would read all these things that would talk about how Crossroads, a shadowy group formed by Republican operator Karl Rove and former RNC chair Ed Gillespie in order to foster conservative pro-business policies. I'm like, well, if they're a shadowy group, they're pretty bad at it, aren't they? I mean, I'm reading the article, everything that's going on. I just don't think it's as hard, by and large, as is suggested. And I want to go a bit beyond your question here, but I'll just add one more thing. And Rick touched on it, about the benefits that are that might be there of people knowing who the donors are. But we should also think about the potential downside as well. For example, if I'm in a group, you have a large number of voters who just really don't think highly of, say, Pakistani and Muslim people, they might be very interested in knowing who's funding a campaign and use it not quite in the way we think. Now, we may think that's okay, that's their right, we want the voters to have information. But I would go back to saying, I would leave it as saying, let's keep government sort of coercion out of it, right? If people want to reveal what they're funding, they can do it. If people don't want to reveal what they're funding, they shouldn't have to do it and let voters decide. You know, there are many times where unpopular causes or people who are unpopular need to want to fund things. And they want to keep their name off it precisely because they want people to judge the proposal on its merits and not because of the race or national origin or just the general unpopularity of the person who is promoting the scheme. So I think that to the extent this has much of an informational effect, which I guess I don't think it has nearly what is routinely the courts say it does. I don't think it's supported by the data. But to the extent it does, it's not clear that this is always beneficial. And I would go back to saying, therefore, there shouldn't be a prohibition on releasing this information. But I don't think that the government should be mandating it either.
Okay. Now we open it up to the cross-questioning, and we lead first off, Rick.
Oh, we ask each other questions.
Yeah, that's right.
I thought we were having audience questions. Oh, I didn't realize that. Okay. So, Brett, let me ask you about the question of foreign influence in elections, and particularly the point you made early on in your opening remarks that the enforcement interest in Buckley isn't really a big deal anymore after Speech Now, because people can give unlimited contributions to independent expenditure committees, and so there's no monetary limit on those contributions. As opposed to, for example, there are limits on contributions to candidates, and we'd want to make sure people were not exceeding that. But what about foreign money in elections? To the extent, as the Supreme Court, in summarily affirming the Blumen case, agreed that foreign spending, it is constitutional under the First Amendment to ban foreign spending on our elections. What about the concern that without adequate disclosure, you could have foreign money coming in through LLCs, through other forms, and it won't be discovered?
I think to some extent, first, this is a overblown scenario. That is, we allow lawful permanent residents, for example, to spend to their heart's content, and we don't worry too much about that. If you haven't noticed, the Russian government runs a full-time cable network in the United States. So yeah, I think they try to influence our elections. I often kind of laugh at all the talk about the Russians because I don't think it's something that Americans should think about or be concerned about, but I sort of feel like, of course the Russians try to influence our elections. I mean, I watched Rocky and Bullwinkle growing up. I mean, we know this, right? This is, what kind of geopolitical rival would they be if they didn't try to influence our elections? I'd lose respect for them. And I say that kind of jokingly, but I do sort of mean it seriously, and I mean it seriously in this respect. As we often had to do, even during times when it was much more serious in the Cold War, we've got to decide what of our rights are we prepared to give up to try to prevent them from polluting our society or, you know, doing that sort of thing. Are we going to make sure we don't go communist, we're going to run the Marxists off the college campuses, you know. What of our rights generally are we going to do? And most of the proposals I see to try to get at this would essentially regulate the rights of Americans to get at what appears to be a very, very small amount of spending by a foreign government, which doesn't appear to be particularly effective in any particular way. So that's why I find myself saying, I get very discouraged when people start jumping and saying, oh my gosh, the Russians might have spent some money, maybe we should act. I kind of feel like, oh my gosh, the Russians might have spent some money, maybe we shouldn't act. Right? Maybe the first thing we should do is make sure that we know what we're talking about and what we're up against and think carefully about where it fits into the game. Now, having said that, of course, one can distinguish between the two. I suppose you could have to pass a rule saying, well, if you get Russian money, you have to disclose it, or foreign money, right? Just as we now have a rule, as Rick pointed out under Blumen, that says if you foreigners can't contribute, non-permanent resident aliens can't contribute to organizations. But of course, U.S. citizens can. So I suppose you could have a rule like that.
So you do agree, though, that just so I have clarity, that the enforcement interest does justify some disclosure of foreign money?
No, I would say it is an interest that people raise, but it has to be, to say does justify is conclusory, I guess. It's a justification for, but it does not justify, like me being really mad at Manny Klausner may be a justification for me walking over there and pounding his face, but it wouldn't make it justified.
Sorry, Manny.
If we can figure out the difference on that. But yes, it's a reason one might argue. I don't think, like I say, what we're really talking about, though, in the end, is we keep talking about rules that are going to apply primarily to Americans, to Americans who do this. So if you want to pass a rule saying an organization that receives money from foreign sources and they participate in political discourse has to disclose that, I'd probably be amenable to that, and I think one could do it under the rule of Blumen. And, you know, as you and I have talked about, I'm not particularly a fan of Blumen, but I do think it's a different constitutional question and one that can survive on that basis.
Now you get to ask Rick a question.
You know what I really would like to do, unless Rick thinks that this is unfair, and it might be unfair because sometimes this is the hardest one, but I took like a lot more time than you did at the beginning. Do you want to just take like 7 minutes and kind of elaborate?
I'd rather open it up for...
Let's just open it up and let's do that.
All right. We have some questions. Professor McConnell over there.
I'm curious, Rick, how much of your position is based on the empirical proposition that disclosure does not lead to terrible consequences for people? And related to that, I wonder, conceptually, what counts as cognizable terrible consequences? So just obviously death threats, yes. But what shy of that, if we found out a lot of people were not being hired or being fired by private people, is that like their right? I mean, I'm thinking of the blacklist during the Red Scare, in which most of us think, oh my goodness, these people not being hired was a pretty serious matter. Or what about, nobody mentioned possible regulatory bias. I have a friend who owns a pretty large but still small business. It's a, you know, in the great scheme of things, a small business. He and his brother are partners, and my friend is very politically interested and likes to give modest, we're talking about relatively small contributions, a few thousand dollars to candidates that he favors. And he told me his brother pleads with him not to do that because they're in a heavily regulated field, and he is convinced that the regulators go on open, what is it, open disclosure?
OpenSecrets.com,
and they find out that he gives to their opponents, and that all the discretion that regulators have gets used against him. So that's another. So people not getting fired. There's regulatory problems. I just wonder what you count as being sufficient, and whether enough bad consequences that you found out that there were a lot of folks who were dissuaded from exercising their right. How much would that sway you if you found out that the facts were somewhat different than how you presented them?
Oh, I think it's a great way of framing the question. And I think that the Supreme Court got it exactly right in Buckley, which is that for the run-of-the-mill kind of election, disclosure serves the important purposes of anti-corruption, enforcing other laws, and providing valuable information to voters, and that there are no credible threats of that someone's going to be face serious harassment. And I'll get to what I think that means in a second. And so if we're talking about, for example, a city council race or a supervisorial race where it's the big developers or it's the teachers union that are secretly backing a candidate, I think voters want to know that because I think it's going to give them, busy voters, valuable information about how they should vote. And so I think that the general construct is a good one, and I think it's extremely rare, although on the conservative side, the examples are trumpeted a lot. And so people, I think, hear it and think that harassment is rampant when I think it's, in fact, extremely rare. So I think that for the most cases, this is not a problem, and a disclosure is very well justified by those interests. In the rare cases, I do think, as the court said, there should be this harassment exemption. I also believe that for people who are not major players, who are giving even maybe $1,000, public disclosure as opposed to disclosure to an election agency is unwarranted. There's no need for me to be able to know I live in Studio City in the San Fernando Valley, the one Trump contributor on my block, who gave $100. I don't need to know that because you know that information doesn't really help anybody with anything. But people who are giving hundreds of thousands of dollars, people giving millions of dollars, I think that is information that we should know. Now, what should count as harassment? I'd go back to the Socialist Workers Party case. I'd go back to the NAACP case, where you had physical violence, threats of physical violence, death threats. You had FBI agents going in and telling telling landlords not to rent to people. So government coercion, government interference, and threats of physical violence, credible threats of physical violence and actual physical violence. That's what I think of as harassment. In terms of economic boycotts, I'm all for it. I think that when Target decided that they were going to support an anti-same-sex marriage candidate for governor in Minnesota, and people started doing protests in Target stores, I thought that was an example of democracy. I don't think of that as harassment. I think of that as something to be celebrated.
Brad?
I'll just say again that generally societies in the West disfavor secondary boycotts, sometimes legally, sometimes just in other ways, and I don't see how it. I think one of the great achievements of the marketplace was to subordinate politics and allow people to trade with one another and then do their politics as well. And so generally I'm not in favor of boycotts and so on. I think it's a miserable way to live your life. And I think that, I do think that people have a right to do that. I'll just leave it there. And then I do want to reemphasize one point, and this isn't anything, Brickton's anything to contrary or anything, but it's just worth remembering again that, when we're talking about the candidate races, of course, all the contributors are disclosed, and I don't think there's any effort to change that. So again, what we're really talking about is groups that are not spending directly to support or contributing directly to candidates, I should say.
If I could just briefly mm-hmm. follow up, there's been a moving of the goalposts in the campaign finance arena. So someone like Senator Mitch McConnell years ago said, I want full and instant disclosure and no limits. Now we're in a situation, thanks to the Supreme Court, of no limits. And now we want less disclosure, just of the candidates. And soon it's going to be, and we saw Justice Scalia make this kind of argument in one of the last cases he heard in the campaign finance hearing. Well, there's so many holes in the laws now that the laws are not effective at all, and so we should get rid of all of them. And so I think that's the next move. So eventually it will be, I can give $10 million to a candidate directly, and it doesn't get disclosure back to the paper bags in the congressman's office.
Well, no, it's not less disclosure. There's no movement, again, for less disclosure. McConnell's not proposing to roll back disclosure to candidates. And when he was speaking in the 1990s, he would be talking about having instant disclosure of contributions. Now, it was never quite clear how far that went. And certainly a lot of people might assume that he meant this independent expenditures and some of these other things of more information. But so maybe the goalposts have moved. Why have the goalposts moved? The goalposts have moved in part because of the sort of insatiable, it seems to me, desire for more and more information coming from the political left. And moreover, the environment they've created of threatening harassment. We have groups on the left that have sent letters to all Republican donors threatening to paw through their personal lives and to sue them in court and stuff if they continue to give to conservative organizations and candidates. Again, we've had this shift from using disclosure as something, as a heuristic device to know what to make of a message, and instead to use it as something that begins with the assumption, I know what I think of this message and I want it stopped, and then used as a way to harass and bully and intimidate those who are engaged in it. The issue does get tougher, I think, as Rick suggests, when you talk large donors who have the ability to sort of protect themselves and are going to have more influence. I mean, one thing we agree on is that the threshold should certainly be raised. I would probably raise it higher than Rick. So it's not, a slam dunk issue, but I go back to saying that there's just not much reason that the government needs it. Again, I think the evidence that this actually serves the intended purpose cited by the Supreme Court in Buckley and sort of invoked as a talisman ever since by the courts isn't really supported empirically.
Next question.
Do we have a way of protecting the public against some sort of a system that we saw with the private foundation receiving tens of millions of dollars from outside sources that then can buy influence because there's relatives involved in the foundation that are deeply involved in the government? In other words, the Clinton Foundation, is that something that we need changes in the law, or is that something that is already prohibited?
For my part, I'll just say I'm going to leave that to the question of foundation and charitable law and so on. And, a lot of that goes to lobbying and influence and simply put the raw power of government, too. I mean, one of the problems in the campaign finance arena generally is we've given government all this power. We've removed so many of the checks on the power. And then we're shocked to discover there's influence peddling going on. And I think that's going to be tough to handle. Rick might have more concrete thoughts.
We'll take two more questions.
Hi, I should first say, Steve Simpson, Ayn Rand Institute. Full disclosure, I co-litigated a case with Brad, so I am on his side. But that said, Brad and I don't agree on everything, right? We work together, we don't agree on everything. And my question goes to that issue. I think, and this is mostly, Rick, for you, but I'd like to hear both of your thoughts on this. Isn't there something false being conveyed by disclosure, to wit, that it's really the donor doing the speaking and not the person who receives the money? I think that's especially true with think tanks. Now, I've worked for two think tanks now both of which have been funded on occasion by the Koch Foundation. And I can assure you, the Kochs do not speak for ARI or for the Institute for Justice, where I used to speak. And the idea that they do is, I find offensive. It's wrong. It's both really tarring the integrity of both parties, and it's just flat out false. And doesn't disclosure, especially mandated disclosure by the government, which is kind of the stamp of government approval on the idea that you should really be paying attention to where the money is coming from, doesn't that convey something that's false? And isn't that part of the troubling issue with disclosure?
I don't think it conveys that message at all. It conveys the message that voters might find this useful, and it lets people look for corruption, and it lets regulators look for violation of the enforcement interest. So the fact that the Koch brothers gave $500,000 to groups aligned with Paul Ryan right after the tax bill passed, which is supposedly going to give them an extra $1 billion of income a year for all the years going forward that this tax bill stays in account, I think that's something the voters would like to know, to be able to assess whether or not Paul Ryan, who is being supported by these groups, should be reelected to his office.
I wasn't going to comment on this, but I did. This tax thing cracks me up. I've seen a lot of reports like Republicans are only pursuing this unpopular tax bill because of their donor base. It's like, are you out of your freaking mind? I mean, I think most people here are probably Republicans. This is like the one thing that, there's two things that unite Republicans. Every Republican except for a handful of people in Congress wants to repeal Obamacare, and every Republican in the country wants tax cuts all the time, period, everywhere. The donors are just speaking for these people, and it always strikes me as this is almost the case that disproves Rick's theory about the heuristic value here, that it's really not necessary.
Okay. One more question.
I had a question about state enforcement of campaign finance laws, and particularly some of the bias that comes into effect when you, with the FEC, you have national scrutiny and media scrutiny. I represent defendants in campaign finance cases in Washington state. Currently, the Attorney General in Washington state has prosecuted entities for a failure to file an independent expenditure that consisted entirely of working on a voter-funded voter's pamphlet statement and speaking to journalists. And these are cases that are, you know, being litigated, that are costing money on the defensive side for those people, and they're not being enforced in an even-handed manner. So I think it's easy to say on a federal level, like, well, these are extraneous examples and they're crazy. But I can tell you out in the real world, in the states, where you have political parties and politically interested enforcement agencies conducting this, it's a genuine problem, and it's something that people are dealing with this year right now in courts.
I certainly agree that, I don't know the specifics of what you're talking about, but I certainly agree that there is unfair enforcement by political actors in campaign finance and in other cases. It's one of the reasons I support nonpartisan election administration. And it's one of the reasons I would support changing the FEC to a different structure than the kind of structure we have. When you're regulating politics, that's always a risk. And so you need to have safeguards in place to make sure that people are not overreaching. And sometimes that involves oversight in the courts and making sure that people's rights are protected in the courts. And there's certainly been situations where campaign finance laws have been misused by officials to try to score political points, and we need to work against that, definitely.
I'll let Rick have the last word. That's good.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much. Let's have a hand for our two...